back to another episode of Positive Altitude. I'm Sylvie.
And I'm Manching.
And this week, we'll be having a deep dive about CEF. And we'll be discussing some of the general concepts around CEF and why or why not are airlines using CEF.
Yep, this is a follow-up into our last episode. If you missed that, that's episode 3, which is about CEF in the Philippines. And we thought that, it's a good idea to get a little bit deeper into this topic. Plus, we got our first listener request by TGC Asia, who also asked us to talk about CEF. So here we are.
Thanks, TGC. Let's get into it. What is CEF and why is everyone in the aviation industry mentioning about it? So for those of you who do not know, CEF is sustainable aviation fuels. And currently it's quite the hot topic now in the aviation industry, especially when you talk about sustainability. So as you know, one of the causes for climate change is the production of CO2. And this is from the burning of fossil fuels. And one of the ways in which the aviation industry can decarbonize and reduce its fossil fuel usage is to use an alternative fuel, which is SAF. And basically, SAF is another form of jet, is similar to jet fuel, but has lower carbon emissions. And it is made of materials such as waste, agricultural output, or any biological output.
So that kind of is a nutshell, but let's talk about some terminology. So these are some of the terms that you always hear around SAF, and you might not understand what it actually means, but here we are to give you like a kind of simple understanding of it. The first one is this concept of drop-in fuel. So when you talk about SAF, it's always described as a drop-in fuel. So what does this mean? This actually means that SAF can be used interchangeably with jet fuel, and that requires no changes in aircraft equipment or the fuel storage and distribution equipment. So that's great news from an airline's perspective, because we don't have to have any upgrades on the aircraft engine or the aircraft itself. And also great news for the fuel suppliers, because they can blend the fuel somewhere else and then use the same tanks and pumps to supply SAF to the aircraft.
And the second terminology would be feedstock. And essentially, feedstock is the raw material used to make sustainable aviation fuel. And there are three types of feedstock: first generation, second generation, and third generation. The first generation being it's produced from edible crops. So this can be from sugarcanes, corn oil, palm oil. Second generations are essentially residues, so such as agricultural waste or used cooking oil. And the third generation, essentially, is typically produced from algae.
Okay, and I get a third one. And this is the life cycle emissions factor or life cycle emissions value of SAF. So bear with me, this is slightly more complicated. So in order to see how SAF reduces the CO2 impact, it is not actually from the burning of the fuel itself in the engine. Because if you burn SAF or you burn jet fuel, it's about the same. It is actually, the savings actually derived from the production process. So if you use fossil fuel extraction, there's flaring, there's environmental impact. So that's considered to be very high carbon impact. But if you are using SAF, you're using actually a renewable waste material or agricultural material, which should have a lower impact. So there are two main values that go into calculating the life cycle emissions value. The first one is the actual life cycle emissions, basically from the production of the fuel. So if you're growing a particular feedstock, what is the carbon emissions associated with that, to the processing, to the collection, and then to the recovery, and basically finally into the engine. And it burns. And the second part is actually a more kind of difficult to calculate part. So essentially, when you're using different generations of feedstock, as Sylvie just mentioned, it creates a different, what is called a land use change emissions. So basically, it just means that if you are using an edible crop, so for example, palm oil or sugarcane or corn oil, you are actually using edible oils that are normally consumed for human use or animal use purposes. And that then creates a demand to deforest new areas to grow more of these crops. And that creates itself a negative carbon impact. So that is taken into account when you calculate the life cycle emissions value of SAF. So typically, when you look at these values, you will find that SAF that is produced using waste materials such as used cooking oil will have a much lower life cycle emissions factor compared to something that is produced using edible oils, for example.
I've got another one, but from a regulatory perspective, and that is mandates. And basically, this is the minimum use requirement of SAF as ordered by government regulation. And for different countries, they have different mandates. For example, here in Malaysia, we are looking at 47% use of SAF by 2050. In Singapore, it's 1% by 2026. So it really depends on the countries.
Right. And I got a nice one, next one, which is really on neat versus blended SAF. Now, although we say that SAF is actually kind of interchangeably usable with jet fuel, currently, the aircraft manufacturers only approve SAF use of up to 50%. So SAF has still to be blended with jet fuel when any airline is using it. You cannot use just solely SAF. So the combination of SAF and jet fuel is called blended SAF. Typically, it will be about 30 to 40% of SAF versus 60% of jet fuel. So you reduce the amount of jet fuel use. The concept of neat SAF usually comes into question when you're talking about the pricing of SAF. So obviously, when you talk about neat SAF, the price is going to be a lot higher. So that's what you want to calculate from just buying the SAF. But there's also a different pricing when you're talking about blended SAF. Then the fuel suppliers will take a component of SAF alone and jet fuel, create a composite price for you.
And I've got one final one on my side, which is electro-SAF, or known as e-SAF. And basically, this is a groundbreaking synthetic fuel. It's not like the sustainable aviation fuel that we're talking about. It's not made from biological feedstocks, but it uses renewable energy to produce hydrogen and then combines, you know, such hydrogen and captured carbon dioxide to produce a clean, low-carbon alternative. So it's more of a next-generation kind of SAF.
Yeah, I think I struggle to really understand that because it's basically synthetic. And, I think it just means that it needs a lot of energy, which we are not ready for right now, unless we have access to a huge amount of renewable energy, which is limited to very few places right now. But this basically captures some of the 5 or 6 key terms that you will always hear about SAF, often hear about SAF. And if you miss out some of that or you would like to read a little bit about it, we also produce a little glossary, a reference book, and that's really called AirAsia's Guide to Aviation Sustainability. It's a really nice booklet which we put a lot of effort into, yep. And it's illustrated. If you would like to get a copy, it's free for download at our Capital A Sustainability website. So please go look it.
Yep, download yours today for free. And let's jump right into it, you know. You know, why has it been difficult to get airlines to use SAF? You know, we've been to many conferences, we've spoken to many stakeholders, many airlines. There's a lot of talk about SAF, but seems like globally there's quite little uptake.
Okay, I'm an economist. I'm going to put on my economist hat and we're going to talk the basics of supply and demand. Now, SAF is challenging because it is not only a product that is constrained by supply, it's also a product that's constrained by demand. So let's talk first about the supply side constraints, right? So firstly, I think we talk about very basically that the first thing you have to do to produce SAF is there's several milestones, key milestones. And the first thing you need to do is to identify a feedstock. And feedstock is something that is not just any bioagricultural material. Of course, you can produce SAF in a lab using this agricultural material. But the challenge is to identify a feedstock that can be secured in large quantities and into the long term as well, because you're not going to invest in SAF production that you can only get a limited quantity of feedstock. So everybody talks now about used cooking oil, obviously, and you know it sounds really nice that if you are using used cooking oil, you can get that oil instead of it going into the drain and clogging it up and turning into SAF. But there are a lot of challenges over collection of cooking oil. So can you imagine if you cook, who's going to come and collect it? How much is that going to cost? And the other challenge is that cooking oil also has other uses. It's also used to produce other biofuels. So if countries want to look at, you know, scaling up SAF in the long term, it has to look at multiple types of feedstock. And each one of them has its own challenges in securing supply and availability as well. And once you've done that, then you have to identify a technological pathway to produce it. Now, globally, I think there are now 7 types of pathways to produce SAF, but very commonly you might hear 3 to treat bio biological feedstock. So the first one is called HEFA process. It's short for hydrotreated esters and fatty acids. So this is typically the method used to treat a feedstock that is oil-based. The second one is called alcohol to jet. So this is to treat sugar-based feedstocks such as molasses using fermentation, which then produces ethanol, which can be converted into SAF. So that's also commonly referred to as ATJ, alcohol to jet. And the last one is called Fischer-Tropsch. And this is really a more high-tech one where you can use to process different type of more low-grade feedstock. It could be down to municipal solid waste. If you can produce municipal waste and turn it into SAF, that would be fantastic. But then you can only use it, do it using a Fischer-Tropsch method.
Yeah, and even if you have, you know, got all these things done, it already sounds like a quite a lengthy process, you still need to get it certified for CORSIA. And this is a challenging process because, as we know, as of today, there's only two organizations that certify SAF, which is the RSB and ISCC organizations. And this certification process requires you to certify the entire production chain. So from where you source the feedstock all the way down the production chain line. And as we know, as of last year, 2023, there are only 9 batches of SAF that has officially been certified under CORSIA, and that's about only 1,500 tons of certified SAF. So, you know, I believe that very few airlines will use uncertified SAF, as it doesn't really amount or count for anything at the end of the day. So this is one aspect that we still need to take into consideration.
Yeah. And the last one is really talking about money, right? SAF is a product that requires huge investment in CAPEX. And let's just put some numbers to it, right? So we know that the biggest SAF facility currently in the world is the Neste facility in Singapore, which can produce a 1 million ton per annum output. So for 1 million ton output of SAF, Neste actually invested 1.6 billion euros in Singapore to expand its facility. So that's a huge amount of money. And the latest one that I saw a couple of days ago is an announcement by a US company called DG Fuels to build the world's largest Fischer-Tropsch facility. And they are actually investing $4 billion to produce 400,000 tons of SAF per annum. So if you combine the output from these two mega projects, which involve between 4 to 6 billion in investment, they produce about 1.4 million tons of SAF output per year. And to be honest, in 2019, that's what AirAsia alone used. So this is... this kind of investment is required for us to fully decarbonize. And, you know, if you look at 2050, by 2050, the estimations right now is that the world needs 350 million tons of SAF if we are to reach net zero.
So that captures our supply side, but what about the demand side of things?
That is another challenge, because one of the things that businesses hate is uncertainty. And the biggest uncertainty that we face now regarding SAF is the price. It is currently, there's no transparent listing of SAF prices. It's not like you can go to a commodity listing and you can say, oh, this is what SAF costs today. In fact, if you go to different fuel suppliers and you ask for different quantities of SAF, you can get a completely different pricing. So if you look at anyone who talks about SAF will give you a price range. They will say something like, oh, SAF costs 3 to 5 times that of jet fuel. Or some people will say 5 to 7 times. And if I'm honest, based on what kind of pricing that we have seen from quotations that is directed to AirAsia or what we've read, SAF is actually now closer to 5 to 10 times the price of jet fuel. Now, when you talk about 5 to 10 times the price of jet fuel, the other aspect you need to look at is how much does fuel cost constitute in an airline's cost structure. So for AirAsia, we're looking at 40 to 50% of our cost is for fuel alone. And if you think about having to, you know, multiply this to anywhere between 2 to 5 times, that is going to make air travel very, very unaffordable. And then the question that we have to talk about is how much of this can we pass on to the consumers? Are consumers willing to pay 3 to 4 times more for the price of travel? Can they afford it? That's one major, major issue, right? And The other part is really about how much governments are willing to allow airlines to pass these costs on to customers as well. Now, I'm not sure what is actually the situation now in other parts of the world, but I can tell you that in Southeast Asia, airfares are actually regulated. It's not free for airlines to just say, I'm going to charge this amount. And the challenge that we face as an airline is that yes, we are facing SAF mandates and we are facing decarbonization pressures. All of the solutions are costly, but if we are supposed to implement this, we have to be able to raise fares as well. But this is not currently the case. So a lot of countries have different priorities and trade-offs. So for one, they want to make sure that air travel is accessible to the general population, because there are some countries which are like Indonesia and Philippines, they're just islands. There are no, you know, viable road or rail transportation. Even in Malaysia, Sylvie, I mean, you go to Penang recently, how long did it take you with the traffic jam?
I mean, I think it would take 4 hours on a good day, but we just recently had a festive season here, the Hari Raya festive season, and one of my colleagues told me that she took 9 hours to get across to the other side of Peninsula Malaysia, so...
Yeah, and that is, you know, with a flight, it would take... 40 minutes to get there. And Malaysia is split between two big chunks. There's another big chunk in Borneo, and there's no way we can get to Borneo. Not even a ship. I never heard of a ship that goes to Borneo. So there are these challenges to consider for this region. But the second one also is that much of the region really depends on the recovery of its tourism sector. Now, I think we all put behind all the things we experienced in COVID and kind of forgotten that it ever happened. But the truth is, very few economies have fully recovered. And even tourism numbers are way below what it was back in 2019. And millions and millions and millions of people in this region depend on tourism for a livelihood. So governments have to also consider the balance of having to revive tourism. In this case, it means having to make air travel accessible, but also clamping it down because of climate change. So we are caught in this very difficult position where, yes, we know that the regulatory pressure is there, but we face limited ability to pass on costs or to raise costs to address some of these challenges.
Yeah, and on top of all these challenges of high prices, you know, government action that's needed, we also know that, you know, SAF, we face the problem of financing SAF, because, you know, SAF is not a collateral, and, you know, obtaining financing is already tough for an airline, and it's even tougher when you're looking at financing for SAF. So I'm sure banks want to see how much we can pass the cost on to our consumers, but if the prices are going up to 5 to 10 times, like Wan Manqing said, how do we ensure that this doesn't collapse demand entirely? You know, will be extremely unpopular in that way.
Yeah, and of course, when you talk about financing, there's also the concept of opportunity costs. So for AirAsia, for example, we did kind of a ballpark calculation that if you use 1% of SAF, it's going to result in $100 million premium on top of what we actually already spend right now. So this $100 million, is it the best use of this $100 million to buy 1% of SAF to decarbonize 0.7 or 0.8% of our CO2 emissions versus investing in aircraft upgrades, which could achieve 1%, but not only 1% in 1 year, but 1% permanently as long as the aircraft remains in operation in our fleet. So unless we have maximized everything, we have the money to fund everything else, our fleet is really tip-top, the most efficient, and we have all the best operational measures available, then there are always other demands on this money that we will have to decarbonize. And as an airline, we would like to, of course, to be able to prioritize the ones that creates the biggest impact and lowest cost and scale up, rather than to be pushed into one direction where we only use one solution to the detriment of being able to look at other options as well.
Yeah, so as a result, we can see that, you know, governments are taking action, and that's where all the mandates are coming from that we mentioned earlier. And I know, Manqing, that at CAFTRIE, you know, the third conference on aviation alternative fuels, there was a global aspiration for airlines to use SAF to reduce at least 5% of their CO2 emissions. So how will this affect us?
Right now, not yet, because these CAFTRIE commitment is a kind of like an aspiration, so it kind of expresses a vision but it's not actually in a regulation form yet. But we know that that could change. I mean, regulatory changes are happening thick and fast in aviation decarbonization. And the actual impact would be that if it becomes regulation, then that creates an additional compliance requirement on airlines. So other than what we talk about CORSIA, so CORSIA actually doesn't require airlines to choose any particular pathways to decarbonize. It basically says, this is the emissions you need to reduce, you can find your best way to use it. But once, if a CAF 3 regulation comes into effect, then it actually has a rider. It means that you have to decarbonize this amount, and X amount has to be done using sustainable aviation fuels. So that also changes the pricing mechanism as well as the cost structure that airlines will face. So that's CAF 3, right? But, you know, will it affect us in this region? So the thing is, right now, regulations are really happening very quickly, and we can see from general developments that Southeast Asian governments are actually taking this quite seriously. Mm-hmm. And the first commitment was actually announced last year, back in August, before CAF 3 in Malaysia, when our National Energy Transition Roadmap actually identified an aspiration to use 1% of SAF up to 47% by 2050. Now, it doesn't state when this 1% will start, but we also cannot imagine it will be very far in the future, because the CAF 3 commitment actually says that we need to decarbonize 5% of our emissions using SAF by 2030. Mm-hmm. So we can imagine the Malaysia one should start 2027, 2028 latest. The other development we've seen was in Singapore at the air show.
Yeah.
So that was Singapore announcing that it will introduce a carbon levy to finance the use of 1% of SAF of all flights departing Singapore. And the others we heard from our colleagues in Thailand who have been communicating with the Civil Aviation Authority of Thailand is Thailand is looking at the 2% mandate by 2026. And I understand Indonesia is also mulling similar regulations. So if I take a bird's eye view of this, I can see that by 2027 at the very latest, we will have to be using some level of SAF.
So we can see that, you know, governments are moving, and there's lots of things going on. I guess the question that our audience will probably want to hear is, you know, is AirAsia ready for the use of SAF?
If you're asking whether we are technologically ready, then yes, absolutely, because we are using the latest generation fleet. Any upgrades that we need to undertake, all the aircraft that we use in many other airlines, they've already been using SAF on 320s and 321s, so that's no issue. But whether we can address the demand side, that's the challenge. And obviously, this is something that we have been kind of also looking internally, when and how much we can also begin internalizing the cost of some of these decarbonization solutions, including SAF. So what we want to avoid is that we face a cliff edge. We don't want to do nothing until 2030 and wham, you have like 5% of SAF and you really be caught. So as a responsible industrial player or airline, and which is also a leading airline in this region, we also recognize the role we have to play to incentivize the market to begin using SAF. So it will start in incremental quantities. And I can definitely say that that will be the direction that most airlines will take. But we definitely can say that AirAsia, that will be our approach. Mm-hmm. As to when that will happen, it will really depend on when more SAF is available in this region. So our preferred way is, of course, to have locally produced SAF, because other than the scope 1 emissions that is generated from the production and the utilization of SAF, we always overlook also the scope 3 emissions. Mm-hmm. Maybe you want to talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, so basically, you know, everyone mentions about scope 1 emissions, which is the use of the jet fuel, but then everyone forgets about, you know, actually this jet fuel needs to be shipped, it needs to be transported to wherever your airport, your airline is at. So people tend to overlook this because it can be, for example, a country like New Zealand. What if they source their SAF from a country, let's say, like Singapore? So the shipping cost all the way to transport that SAF from Singapore to New Zealand, that would produce lots of CO2. So it kind of is a little bit redundant if you look at it.
If you ignore the scope 3. So I think it's important to kind of recognize like the big picture of all the things that we are doing and not just focus on one thing and, you know, sort of ignore the other side just because mm-hmm. people are not asking you about it. The second part of it, obviously, is a part of ramping up production. And we want, ideally, for all countries to be able to have their own. Because when we talk about feedstock, it's different countries having different feedstock. Not one country have a huge amount of feedstock. So it could be similar to the kind of landscape in the US where we're not talking about one massive producer which produces for everyone, but it could be smaller plants that can produce sufficient for one major airport or mm-hmm. one major island, say in the Philippines, you know, that one that uses sugar cane, another one that uses another type of feedstock. So all those things are still kind of in discussion. In fact, that's why we had that episode last week in the Philippines to kind of see what's happening in the Philippines. I'll be going to Indonesia soon also to kind of see what is happening in Indonesia as well as Thailand. So yes, that means there's a lot of things that's happening, and I can see that there's a lot of excitement about it. I mean, we are cautiously excited about it, obviously, because we know that ultimately we are the ones who have to kind of absorb the cost and find a way to pass it on to consumers. But I think the most important part is now for us, and that's one of the reasons why we're doing this podcast, is also to educate people that, you know, it's not just a miracle pill that you can drop into the water and it will solve all our problems. Mm-hmm. And as an airline, we find ourselves having to tackle things that we never expect to have to tackle. Why would we have to look into fuel production? We just were fuel consumers, but now we have to look at fuel production as well, because in countries like in the US, you know, in Europe, there's like big policy, you know, the US can afford to give subsidies, huge amounts of subsidies to incentivize production. The EU has massive funds in order to support development and research in the SAF. But when you're talking about smaller countries in Southeast Asia, then we just don't have those funds. And we don't have that kind of technological capability as well. Maybe in Malaysia, yes, we have companies like Petronas can look into it, but that's not always the case in all the countries that we operate. So as an airline, we actually find ourselves having to take a bigger role to also incentivize the market. So it's a big burden to carry, and it also needs consumers to understand that eventually they have to be responsible for part of the cost as well, because there's no way we can ensure that aviation remains accessible and have airlines absorb all the costs.
Yeah, I think at the end of the day, it's a shared responsibility between the consumers and the airlines in that sense. But yeah, I guess to wrap it up, what can we expect from AirAsia in the meantime?
Well, in the short term, of course, we will continue to work on what we have been doing very well in decarbonization, as really look at how we can improve efficiency, because efficiency is the key to this, because if you are very inefficient, you're wasteful. You will be burning more money than you need to, because whether you're burning jet fuel or SAF, it's going to be burning money. So our focus is still to look at efficiency measures. So I'm happy to say, actually, today we've got one new efficiency measure approved by the Civil Aviation Authority of Malaysia that's going to help us save fuel consumption on the flights as well. So we continue will be to drive that. But in parallel, yes, we are having some close negotiations with partners on SAF. How do we support some of the R&D? How do we also start looking at potentially securing some supply in the future? But I can't talk too much about that, so that's still subject to the board. So you know, watch this space.
Yeah, watch this space, and lots of exciting things happening. But yeah, I think that's a wrap for our SAF episode. I think that's all we wanted to say about SAF.
Yep, and if you have any questions, please feel free to drop us a note in LinkedIn or any other channel that you can try to reach us. But otherwise, let us know what else you want to hear about next.
Thanks for tuning in to Positive Altitude.
Bye.